It's one of the problems with the two-hour course. You don't have time, and if you know this is structured, you don't have time to do much testing. Well, let's on page 47 of our syllabus, I put this in as a parenthetical study and I'm not going to go over that with you in detail. I'm going to wait and go over that with you if we have time at the end of the quarter. I put that in here, it's a parenthetical value, because it's called Daniel 9 and Watchtower Chronology, and I point out that the Watchtower timetable of 1914, which is a key date for the Jehovah's Witnesses, is based upon a date of 607 for the fall of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem didn't fall in 607. Their whole eschatology hinges on the year 1914. And this is just for a useful study to have. And it's all based, Russell and his crowd weren't very good Bible scholars. And they based on that. Jehovah's Witnesses are the only people in the world who teach that Jerusalem was destroyed in 607.
At the time they started teaching this, they might have not known as enough. Now that there's been new evidence.
Well, even at that, it was just flat doodle scholarship. That's typical Jehovah's Witness, Mickey Mouse stuff. But they're the only ones in the world who teach that. They have to. Or lose their date 1914. They built too much on that. And I trace this for you. I'll look it over. If we have time at the end of the quarter, we'll go over that. But let's move on now. Make sure we finish. We come to Daniel in the lion's den. And again, this is an easy chapter. After going through Daniel 9, we're ready for one, are we not? That was tough. Again, this is one of the stories one of the first stories you heard in the beginner's department, the primary department in Sunday school, right? Daniel, and la la la. You sing that stupid little song? No. It sounds better than it does when I sing it. Daniel in the lion's den. Now, it's one of these stories it would never have occurred to the ancients that it would be a children's story. You ever seen anybody thrown in a lion's den? It's not a pretty thing. Anybody ever been in a lion's den did not think it was a children's story. I don't find that out by experience. But we find Daniel 6, this is under the Persians. We find him under the Persians. It seemed good to Darius, Daniel 6, 1 and following, to appoint 120 satraps. That's a Persian word for a ruler, a governor, an administrator, over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom. And over them, three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one. Now, the interesting thing is, what had Belshazzar promised Daniel if he would interpret the handwriting on the wall? No. Be a ruler of a third of the kingdom. It's interesting that God apparently gave Daniel that unto the Persians. Now, why would the Persians you put Daniel in a place where he was the ruler of a third? He was one of three commissioners who oversaw the satraps, who oversaw the Persian Empire.
They understood him and his power to some degree and didn't want to upset his God after obviously what had happened.
Yeah. Suppose they were told about what Daniel had done. Does it seem unbelievable that Daniel would, who was a ruler of the Babylonians, administrator of the Babylonians, become a administrator of the Persians? Does that sound like a fairy tale? Too good to be true? Couldn't be true? Well, I think it's the very thing we would expect. You see, the ancient Oriental mind would think this way, that if Daniel, the ancient Oriental mind, did not make a distinction that we would make between the message and the messenger. You are familiar with the habit, are you not, of when kings receive bad news, they kill the messenger? Very common thing. It seems very strange to us. They would kill the messenger. On the other hand, if the news was good, they would reward the messenger. There's no logic in that. The messenger is just the messenger. It was a part of the Oriental mindset. That's just the way they did it at upper levels. You got that? Kill the messenger or punish the messenger if it's bad news. And reward the messenger if it's good news. Now, if you understand that, it helps us to understand that Daniel had been the bearer of good news for the Persians. Undoubtedly, it was told to Darius, who was Gobrius or Gubaru, you know him from the cuneiform text, all about what happened at Belshazzar's feast. And the conclusion would be, well, it's obvious that it's obvious that Daniel is used of the God of God or the gods. If he predicted, note this, if he predicted the fall of Babylon and the victory of the Persians, then he would be, that favor would be transferred to the predictor. See what I'm saying? They would look favorably upon that. They would transfer that to Daniel, the Oriental mind. Am I making this clear? That is, they would transfer, they would mix up cause and effect. They would say, look, in other words, he would receive, what I'm saying is that Daniel would in some sense receive credit in the mind of the Persians for their victory over the Babylonians, simply because he predicted it. That's how I want to say it. Now again, that has to be explained to the modern Western mind, because there's no logic to it. You understand, the fact that he would predict it would not mean that he in any way would be credited with it, this victory, but he would be by the Persians. Does that make sense to you? It's a strange thing to try to explain. Now, I misspoke myself earlier. I said that the satraps were over the whole Persian Empire. I didn't mean to say that. You see, if you look at the wording here, Darius, this who was Darius the Mede? This Gubaru was put over that part of the Persian Empire that had been coextensive with the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Understand? He was not over the whole Persian Empire. He was over that part of the empire which had been Babylon. And this Darius put 30 commissioners over that part of the kingdom, the empire, and Daniel was the ruler of a third. So Daniel ended up being a ruler of a third of the Babylonian Empire anyway, of what had been the Babylonian Empire. That's what I meant to say. Did y'all understand that? It's my third hour to teach now. I'm not sure I'm any connection between what's going on in my mind and what's coming out of my mouth. You think it's bad now, just wait a few minutes. It's going to get worse. I promise you. Okay. But I think there's an irony there, isn't it, that he got it after all. Okay, he was over these three commissioners, verse 2, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Does that mean Cyrus was going to put him in the place of Darius? Or does it mean Darius was going to give him sole responsibility? Which king is he talking about? I'm not sure. As I say in the syllabus, Darius was making sure that his superior, which was Cyrus, was not dissatisfied. So it depends on what king you're talking about. It's probably Darius was going to put Daniel over, make him the sole administrator under him, because Daniel was so successful. Well, I'm pretty sure that's what it means. It doesn't say which king. Then the commissioners, that is the other two commissioners, and satraps, that is under them, begin trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he, that is Daniel, was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Now, why were these men trying to do this, trying to find something against Daniel? Charges of corruption, Iran gate, whatever. Why? Well, simple jealousy. They're going to lose their positions, or they're going to have to answer to Daniel. Once you're top dog, it's hard to move down the corporate ladder or the bureaucratic ladder. And they didn't want to move down. But, so they tried to accuse him of something, but Daniel played it straight. Couldn't accuse him of anything. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel, unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." This was his Achilles heel. The only place we can get at him is his religion. Because Daniel that was the only way he was different from them, his faith. And listen to me, does this not tell you that Daniel had been faithful to his religion, faithful to his faith? It certainly does. So then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. "King Darius, live forever," the standard Oriental greeting. "All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den." Now, note this, note the polytheism, not saying not ruling out the other gods, simply saying all acts of devotion for 30 days shall be given to you. This is the Oriental concept of the divine emperor. Now, what are they appealing to in Darius? His vanity, his Oriental vanity. He did not know what they were getting at. He could find nothing wrong with it. And so he thought, why not? You know, men like to be worshipped. Every married woman knows that. What are you laughing about, Renee? You're not married.
She's not.
It's true, though, isn't it? Men are naturally arrogant. All men, more than women. I'm not, but I've always been very proud of my humility. But other men are arrogant, and men in high places tend to be arrogant, and Oriental rulers tend to be very arrogant. When you start thinking of yourself as a god, that takes something. Now, and so he did not see what they were getting at. This was a plot. "Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked." Now, what is this? This has come into our language. Often a man in a business meeting or a faculty meeting will say, "Well, this is not the law of the Medes and the Persians." What do they mean by it? Yeah, we can change it if we want to. Now, let me explain the Medes and the Persians had a law that once it was decreed by the king, it could not be changed. Now, the background, they weren't the only ones who had this idea. The background of this is the idea of the divinity or the deity of the king. That is, that his decrees are the law of heaven, and therefore divine revelation. You understand this? For instance, you go back to an earlier period, the law code of a millennium before this, the law code of Hammurabi. Remember we studied in the code of Ishnanu and Lipit Ishtar, we studied those in Western Civ 1. What was the source of those law codes? They came from the gods. Well, the law of Moses came from God, did it not? The law of Moses was the law of God, and it could not be changed. So you understand, so this, the background of this is the idea that these laws, these decrees, are divine decrees. Because they come from the gods, they cannot be changed. Because the emperor himself is deity, that's the background of that, irrevocable. "Now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house." Now his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. "And he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously." Now, here we have this very interesting piece of information that Daniel prayed three times a day toward Jerusalem. What does this indicate to us? Look in the syllabus. Indicates the centrality of the temple. Why would he pray toward Jerusalem? So the temple would have been. And three times a day goes back to very early times. Tradition to dedicate call for Christians to pray three times a day. Now, as you know, when the Muslims pray, they face Mecca. When the Baptists pray, they face Dallas. just wait for that. Right? No. And when we pray, we face Cincinnati, right? No. No. Just teasing.
You don't face Cane Ridge or...
And then, you know, of course, here on this campus, when we pray, we face Dr. Smith's office. But that is sound theology. Yeah, I know. There has to be a focal point of our devotion. The custom of looking toward Jerusalem dates back to Solomon. 1 Kings 8:48 and 49, you can read that. I don't have any time to read it. So Daniel, what I'm saying is that Daniel was following a custom. Because the temple, you see, could only be at Jerusalem. Jews, it was a very common thing to pray facing Jerusalem. Indicated, as you know, in the first century, for example, Jerusalem was the center of Judaism only in the emotional sense. The temple was the center of Jewish religion only in a spiritual sense. Most Jews, devout Jews, never saw Jerusalem or the temple. They would send money to support it. Remember the offering, the Romans allowed that offering once a year. So there was this devotion, but it was not because they lived there. Most, as you know, only a tiny fraction of the Jews lived in Judea at the time of Jesus. But it was the emotional. So you see what I'm saying? Even while they're in exile, or the diaspora, the dispersion, it was the emotional or spiritual center. Thus they would look toward Jerusalem. Now, so this was his custom. Three times a day. The Muslims pray how many times a day? Three or four times? Five times a day. That's right, five times a day. I remember one time I was in Cairo in a travel agency trying to make arrangements for a student to fly back to America. And they have these prayer, they have at public places, they have little boxes with the prayer rug in it. And they're just there. Nobody steals it. And I was there for about an hour or so, and I just looked out the window and enjoyed it. And saw the different ones that come along. They take the prayer cloth out, roll it out, and kneel down and say their prayer, and then roll it up, put it back. It's a public prayer. The carpet about this long. And interesting, you see one man come along, he'd have the traditional Arab garb, you know, with the burnous, long robe. Another man come along in a three-piece pinstripe suit, an ascot tie, and he'd do exactly the same thing. Take off his shoes, and take off his shoe down, and said the same, pretty exactly, prayed and bowed at the same time, exactly the same prayer. Okay, so they find him praying. In his house. And note this, that did Daniel know that the decree had been signed? Did he know that this was now illegal? Did it anyway. Why? We ought to obey God and not men. We ought to obey the government as much as we can. The government says, don't do this and don't do that. We obey. But the government says you can't pray. It's time to disobey the government. Then these men, verse 11, came by agreement and found Daniel, spying on him, making petition and supplication before his God. They approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? Now, and the king answered and said, the statement is true. According to the law of the Medes and the Persians, cannot be revoked. Now, this has the ring of historicity about it. What's the other form of capital punishment we've seen in Daniel? Fire. The burning of people alive and the throwing of the lion, which was a common means of putting to death notable criminals. that wasn't the only means of execution, but they would put them in the lion's den if they were serious criminals. That is, if you broke a minor law, say you murdered a citizen, you might be put to death, but you would be thrown in the lion's den. The lion's den was reserved for those who broke the decrees of the king, traitors, notable criminals, threats to society. Why? Well, the idea was you make an example of them. So they said, King, Darius said, did you make this decree? Yeah, I sure did. Then they answered and spoke before the king. Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition 3 times a day. Now when the king, as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. Even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. See, right away he saw that he'd been trapped.
Is there some legal precedent for sundown? Is that somebody been accused of something they have till sundown that day?
No. Okay. He just worked all, he spent all day trying to figure out how to get Daniel off the hook. Then these men came by agreement. See, by that means they're plotting, verse 15. The plot goes on. And came by agreement to the king, said to the king, recognize, O king, that it's the law of the Medes and the Persians, that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. See what they're doing? They're pressing for his death. And when the king didn't act immediately, they had a meeting. And they said, what's going on? Daniel should have been killed before now. Now here they're being very foolish. These fellows aren't very bright. What they're doing is, it wasn't very smart in those days to get your, if you were an Oriental, these Oriental courts, to get the king, to make the king do something he didn't really want to do. And we're going to find they're going to pay for that. That's a law of human nature. You know, you can force somebody to do something that they don't really want to do, but they're going to remember it. And these men are really destroying themselves. So they had this meeting, and Daniel's still alive. And so they, now keep in mind, they have put their lives on the line. Suppose the king found a way to forgive Daniel, and the king went ahead with his plans to put Daniel over them. Where would that leave them? Would Daniel know about this? How would you like to have somebody who had the power of life and death over you, whom you had tried to get killed? To have killed. Understand, if Daniel was over them, Daniel would have the power of life and death over them. And they would, understand? So they had to, they had put themselves in a position, it was either, I think this is why they went, it was either him or us. Why would they go back and press the matter with the king, knowing that they were forcing the king to do something he didn't want to do? Because their lives were on the line anyway. Certainly their careers. Because you don't try to get a man killed and then he's your boss. Then the king couldn't find a way out of it. Then the king gave orders, reluctantly, you see. And Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, your God whom you constantly serve will himself deliver you. Now what is the king saying? Is he expressing a biblical kind of faith? Well, on what basis did he say, your king, your God will deliver you? Now, grammatically speaking, he may have said, may your God deliver you. Or will your God deliver you? It may have just, it can be translated that way. The Hebrew is not exactly exact. Look what I put in the syllabus. Did he know about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? No, we don't know. It's not really. That was in the early Babylonian period. That's a long time. Understand? 50 or 60 years have passed. I'm just guessing. I see. Well, keep in mind. Now, by the way, how old is Daniel? This takes place. Yeah, it's what? Over 70. Yeah. I like this. over 70, he's still got a lot of gravel in his gut and spit in his eye, and he's not going to back down no matter what. He hasn't changed. I like to see a man who preserves the faith of his youth into his old age, who sticks with it. Daniel certainly did. But this was a long time ago. Could he understand? You might say, well, he'd heard about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they've been delivered, so he's saying, this is the same God, he'll do it again. I don't know. Would a Persian ruler have known about something that happened many decades before in a Babylonian court? It's possible. It's possible. It certainly would have been talked around. I prefer the second one, but he's saying, may your God deliver you. But I'm not ruling out the first one. It's hard to reconstruct it exactly. It doesn't make that much difference. And a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den. Now the den was, often you see pictures of this where it's kind of like a cage and Daniel's put in a cage. I saw a TV, made for TV movie on this, at least Bible history series, which is very well produced, not very sophisticated. Pictured like a cage, put Daniel in a cage. No, it was a hole in the ground. It was a den. Understand? There would be a hole here and you would look down and see it down there. And so the stone was, so they put Daniel in. They would lower him in, or drop him in, probably lower him in. A stone was brought laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet ring of his nobles so that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel. Why did he do that?
So nobody could accuse him about letting Daniel out of
it. Yes.
Are those nobles probably the same crew that's trying to get him? In other words, okay, guys.
The same ones, yes. Why would he seal it? Well, it shows the official nature of it, but if he really thought that Daniel, in other words, he's saying, nobody's going to open this but me. That's what that seal meant. Nobody but I is going to open this. Now, did he have the hope that Daniel's God would deliver him? I think so. A genuine hope. Now, and he was probably sealed to make sure that Daniel's enemies didn't come and help the lions along. That is, if God delivered him, delivered him from the lions, he didn't want him murdered. There's a certain illogic in that. If God could deliver him from the lions, he could certainly deliver him from these men. But he seems to want everything done so that later on there can be no accusations that he did not keep the law of the Medes and the Persians. There's no tampering, regardless of why he did it. He may have done it to protect Daniel from the nobles, from the commissioners. I don't necessarily think that's true. But he's removing all doubt. I'm going to play this straight. Then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting. And no entertainment was brought before him, and his sheep in his sleep. Sheep. I told you it's going to get worse. His sleep fled from him. Now, was this a religious fasting? I don't think so. Was he praying for Daniel? I don't think so. I think he was so mad, upset, that he just couldn't eat. Didn't want the entertainment brought to him. You know, he didn't want to watch Gilligan's Island that night, or whatever entertainment was. Whatever they brought in. And he couldn't sleep. Now, does this tell you, this Darius? I like Darius. He seems to be a straight-up fellow, does he not? And it shows his concern for, note this, it shows the high regard he had for Daniel. What does it say earlier in this chapter? He had the plans in motion to make Daniel the single ruler, single commissioner, most likely. And he really was devoted to Daniel. And note this, there may have been some selfish motives in it. Was it just personal affection for Daniel that caused him to not be able to eat and not be able to sleep? I don't think it was just personal affection. You see, his job was on the line in a way. You see, he answered to Cyrus for the well-being of that part of the empire. You got that? He was responsible to Cyrus. And that was no small thing. You could lose your life quite easily if you failed in the Oriental world. And Daniel was making him look good. I kind of think it was maybe this this more than personal affection. Well, it may have been both. But you see, the things were going well because of Daniel's administration. So well that he was going to put Daniel over everything. Because as that part of the empire went, so did his political fortunes go. And the idea of him losing a man like Daniel and having all this trouble, what I'm saying is, this trouble that was caused, where these commissioners were out to get Daniel and he might lose Daniel, and especially under these circumstances, it would disrupt the administration of his part of the empire. So he had bureaucratic reasons, we would say, practical reasons for being upset. You're going to lose a top man. And plus, these other commissioners, which were trusted men, I think he was angry. Again, I think he was madder than a wet hen at being forced to do something he didn't want to do by a trick. A man like that hates to be tricked, don't you? He got maneuvered, got snookered, and he didn't like it. Anyway, he can't. Now I say this because of how he acts later on. I think there's grounds for saying that. Verse 19. Then the king arose with the dawn, at the break of day, first thing in the morning, went in haste to the lion's den. When he came near to the den, he cried out with a troubled voice. Then the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God whom you constantly serve and able to deliver you from the lions?" Why did he holler? Why didn't he just look and see?
Didn't hear a voice anymore.
Couldn't see. The storm was over the pit. He couldn't see in. It's a hole. Understand? So he hollered. He's shouting. Then Daniel spoke to the king. "O king, live forever." That's the standard. That's the way you greeted a king. "O king, live forever." Boy, he's glad to hear that. "My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. And also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime." Well, had he committed a crime? Well, technically, yes. But not that. But see, that was not the intent of Darius. Darius got, this is what he's saying. Darius, you and I both know that this was a plot, and that I'm not disloyal to you. My praying to my God, you and I both know, does not mean I'm disloyal to you. I've not sinned against you. You know that. He knew that. Interesting. An angel came. Your God saying, "Well, I got on the." I wonder if it's the same angel that got the Hebrew children out of the fire furnace. I think it was. You see this angel. The angels have personalities. I don't mean to be facetious. The angel said, "Oh, here we go again." It's not one fool thing, it's another. He comes and shut the lions' mouths. What does that mean? Well, Daniel was not on their menu that day. And these lions would have been kept. You see the miracle in this, or the supernatural character of this. That these lions were kept ravenous. The Romans did this with dogs. They killed Christians in the Colosseum with wild animals, and they would starve them for days and taunt them. What they would do is, the Romans would do is, they would starve these hyenas or dogs or bears or wolves, whatever animals they were using. They would starve them for days, and then they would taunt them with fresh meat on a fork and stick it in and pull it back. And just get them ravenous, then they'd let them out on the Christians. And that, what I'm saying is, this is how they did that. It wasn't just, it wasn't the fact that the lions just were full, and just didn't happen to attack. We're going to see later that they were very ravenous. And the fact that that Daniel was still alive would have taken an angel or something like that. Then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up. How would they get him up out? Let a rope down to him. Was taken up out of the den, and no injury was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Now the king kept the law. The law was, if you don't, you're going to be thrown in the lion's den if you pray to any other god. Well, they'd been thrown. It didn't say the lions had to eat him. He had kept the law. But now he's kept the law. Nobody can accuse him of breaking the law of the Medes and the Persians, right? He put him in, he put his seal on it. Every I has been dotted, every T has been crossed. He's done it. Now, He's going to do something else. The king gave orders that those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children and their wives, into the lion's den. Now, why the children and the wives? Well, again, I put this in the syllabus. The families are destroyed. This was the Persian custom. I'm reading now, probably reflecting the conviction that the tendency to crime was hereditary. Also, it intensified the deterring effect of this form of capital punishment. Now, through the ancient world, up through the end of the classical period, for major crimes like this, like treason, they would kill the whole family. I remember when, in the days of Tiberius, when Sejanus, his evil cohort, was put to death. One of the pathetic stories of the coming out of the ancient world where Sejanus had a daughter who was 8 years old, I think, or 6 years old. And she's in the cart going with the rest of them to execution. She doesn't understand it. She says, "Well, somebody just tell me what I did wrong. I'll never do it again." But you see, the ancients had this concept that evil was hereditary. Until very recent times, the idea of bad seed or bad blood, I think I mentioned this before in another class, you see anachronisms. When you study history, you see anachronisms in all the time. For instance, I can remember on show years ago when I saw Gunsmoke on TV, Kitty and Doc and the Marshall Dillon are sitting at the Long Branch Saloon talking about why this criminal went bad. And they were saying, well, you know, his father mistreated him. Very modern psychology. Well, which is not what they would have said in 1870 or 1850. What would they have said? Bad blood. His daddy was not worth shooting, and it's, you know, like father, like son. Understand? They would not have talked about environmental influence. They would have talked about the fact that he was born with his daddy's blood. So you see what I'm saying? That it intensified the deterrent, but their idea would just remove the whole bunch, because if one's bad, they're all bad. That's an Oriental concept. Well, we see the ravenous appetite of the lions, don't we? And it underscores the supernatural character of Daniel's deliverance. And they had not reached, verse 24, and they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. They would drop, let them in by ropes, or however they got them in. They didn't even touch the ground before the lions were on them. That's quite a slow. Now, there were probably a lot of lions, probably a large den. And, these men did put their life on the line by making Darius do something he didn't want to do. And he certainly wasn't going to have these men retain their position. He was furious at them. They weren't very smart, were they? See, even if they had worked it out, here you see human nature, the blindness that hatred creates. Boy, if somebody hates somebody and is jealous, rationality, reason often goes out the window. Suppose Daniel had been killed by the lions; they'd got their way. Where would that left them? See, again, they had incurred the displeasure, the extreme displeasure of their monarch. It wasn't very smart. Then Darius the king wrote to all peoples, nations, men of every language who are living in the land, "May your peace abound." And this was an inscription, the decree of Darius, which would be put on stone tablets, probably, or at least written out and sent out to be read throughout the kingdom. A decree spread. And then Daniel records the decree. "I make a decree that in all dominions of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. He is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever. He delivers, rescues, and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." Who do you think wrote this? Probably Daniel wrote it. He probably said, "Don't you write up a decree, Daniel, and I'll sign it."
Just out of curiosity, do they have any tablets?
May not have been put on stone tablets. I said it may have been. Probably it was just read. But note that you see that, again, the historical authenticity of this. May your peace abound. That's how it would start. That would be the greeting, the heading of it. And so like, dear subjects, or, you know, dear John, may your peace abound. Then Daniel probably worded it. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. That is, Cyrus over Darius. He's simply saying, that's a good way of dating it. You know, Cyrus was the king of the whole Persian Empire, Darius over that part of it. Okay, I bet you never studied the Daniel the Lion's Den that way. Usually it's, you probably hadn't studied it since you were in Vacation Bible School. Okay, we're coming now to the final vision. We're coming out about right on our syllabus, I think. It's a little... Yeah. So the rest of our study, we have more than one discussion, but the rest of our study is in the final vision.